Stand rock solid, oh you lovers, stand with me. Rise in spirit, oh you lovers, rise in me. Sing together, oh you lovers, sing with me.
Hello everybody, I'm T. Thorne Coyle. Welcome to Elemental Castings, my bi-monthly walk through magic and the elements of life. Today's podcast is on air. The powers of speech and poetry and song and the movement of that beautiful element of life flowing through our bodies and coming through our voices, the energy of dawn and new beginnings. And today's guest is R.J. Stewart. R.J. Stewart is a Scottish author and musician now living in Northern California. In 1997, he was admitted into the USA as a resident alien of extraordinary ability, a category awarded to exceptional creative artists and scientists. RJ is the author of 43 books and has composed music for film, television, and theater. His books on the underworld and fairy traditions and on practical magical arts have influenced many people over the last 30 years. In the 1980s, RJ started the Inner Temple's Inner Convocation Program, which now has trained teachers and groups of students in the U.S., Canada, Britain, Europe, and South America. You can find him at rjstewart.org and rjstewart.net. And as usual, you can find me at thorncoil.com. So I want to invite us all to take in a breath of this beautiful air together before we start. And honor all the elements of life, air, fire, water, earth, and ether. And say, Holy Mother, in whom we live, move, and have our being, from you all things emerge, and unto you all things return. And RJ, do you have an invocation for us?
Yes, I do. Let us consider the Temple of the East, the inner hidden temple, which is the temple of instruction and inspiration. Because in our consciousness, the element of air brings us inspiration. And in our magical work, in our spiritual, our creative work, the Temple of the East is the temple where instruction is given and where we receive instruction from those other dimensions of the spirit world that seek to work with us. So that's what I would invoke for us all here, instruction and inspiration.
Thank you. That's beautiful. So, RJ, you have been a magic worker and a musician for many, many years. And I'm wondering, can you trace which came first, the magic or the music?
Well, it's not an easy question to answer, but I think very briefly what happened first was the music, because I was in my teens and there was a big craze for acoustic blues in Britain. And then also traditional folk music, which I got into, which of course has many magical and spiritual things in it. And from there, I got into the Western esoteric magical tradition when most people around me were into Eastern things.
So where was your early training then in the Western esoteric traditions?
I started off with just, you know, like many, many people, trying to meditate and trying to find out how to meditate. And one of the things that happened, which was quite a surprise to me at the time, I suppose I was about 18, was I actually made contact with what nowadays we would call an inner contact, an inner world teacher, who would appear to me and teach me meditation techniques. And then one day I was in the reference library, this was in the city of Bristol in the west of England, And there I found a newly published book. I can even tell you the year. It was 1968. And it was called Magical Ritual Methods by W.G. Gray. And so when I got back to my little musician's garret, you know, complete with mice and dust and starvation, but it was good, I got back there, and I did my meditation, and this inner world teacher appeared in my consciousness and said, "You found the book. You won't see me again." And I've never seen him again. But I started working from William G. Gray's book, Magical Ritual Methods.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got into correspondence with the author. In those days, I don't know if you remember this, Thorne, we had things like paper letters you'd stick in the mail. I put this paper letter in the mail to the publisher, who incidentally was Gareth Knight, the famous esotericist, was actually Bill Gray's publisher back then. And I got a reply from Bill Gray, and eventually, very timid and shy, I started going up to Cheltenham on the train to meet him and his wife, Roberta. And Roberta was an astrologer and a really amazing expert on Celtic tradition. Back in those days when Celtic was not cool and fashionable and nobody was interested in it.
Right.
So that was how I got started.
Mm-hmm. I find it really interesting that your early work had this Celtic magical influence. And, you know, someone that I might think of as a predecessor of yours in the magical and bardic tradition, you know, people like Yeats, you know, of course, were very interested both in the emerging Western esotericism of the Golden Dawn and also in the Celtic gods and myths. Do you feel any kinship with people like Yeats as spiritual ancestors?
I do. I feel this very strongly. I remember years ago somewhere I read something. You may be familiar with this. It was new to me, but I think it's a well-known thing that in the Orphic tradition, Orpheus is regarded as the first ancestor of all poets and singers.
Mm.
So if you're a poet or singer, Orpheus is your ancestor,
mm-hmm.
no matter what your nationality, no matter what your tradition. And I think the same applies in the kind of more specific lines that I work in, which are indeed what today we call Celtic. The fairy stuff, the underworld stuff is all Gaelic or Celtic in many ways. And so Yeats and, of course, the remarkable figure of William Sharp Fiona MacLeod,
right.
Very powerful, magical writer. And A.E., George William Russell, and a number of other people of that era are in many ways people I would think of as my creative and spiritual ancestors, yes.
Mm-hmm. Are there particular deities you work with to help inspire you?
Well, this is a question I've been thinking a lot about recently, because, you know, we all start off in our magic, and we all say, and we've all done it, and we all know it, we say, I am a priestess of X,
right.
Or I am a priest of Y. And for a long time, I lived in Bath in England, and I thought of myself as a priest of the goddess Sewell, who is an underworld goddess of prophecy, childbirth, and regeneration. And I worked with her for a long, long time, maybe 18 years. But I was doing other things as well. And then when I finally left there, I stopped thinking of myself as being a priest of X, that Sewell in that case, and felt that the next thing for all of us is to be just a priestess,
mm-hmm.
just a priest. And that is not to minimize our power, it's to maximize it and to make it far, far greater, because you can be a priest or priestess of any god or goddess if you have focus and you have balance.
I think that's really interesting, RG, because the same thing has happened to me. For years, I was definitely a priestess of Brigid, you know.
Yeah.
And I still do work with Brigid. She's still important to me. Yet, the more my magical practice developed, the more my bardic practice developed, the more skill and authority I grew into, the more I've had your experience of now I'm just a priest, a priestess, and I can have many relationships with different deities, but really my primary relationship is with my own godhood and therefore with the limitless divinity that flows through all gods, all goddesses, the earth, the cosmos, all the realms seen and unseen. And what I'm thinking here is that this dedication to a god or goddess as a patron or matron is an important part of our training. Because we don't start out with that focus you're talking about, right? We have to develop it along with everything else. And I think having a deity form to enter into deep relationship helps deepen the rest of our magic.
Yes, thank you for saying that. That's very, very important for us. So really, you're saying that the god-goddess experience, I am a priestess of X, is an important part of our training, but it's not our ending. It's really an important beginning.
Yes. And it's important to not skip that by saying, well, I just need to leap ahead into being a priestess of everything. It doesn't work. It doesn't work that way. Do you agree with that?
I do agree. I think that's a very shrewd observation because it applies. Magic is like, in spiritual work, it's like any other skill. You know, it's like a manual skill. It's like woodworking. It's like carving. It's like a creative skill, painting or playing music. You don't get to be good at it by trying to do every aspect of it all at once when you begin.
That's right.
But if you get really highly skilled in certain areas, you then find later on it's easy to expand into others because of the coordination, the mental focus, and the experience, of course.
No one becomes an adept without that sort of in-depth process. And that's been true, I'm sure, of your music as well. Your writing.
These sort of questions are often very difficult to answer because I'm sure a lot of creative people will have told you this, and you'll have found this yourself with your own creative work. When you look back on what you've done, you think, well, it was all pretty haphazard. I did that. I wrote that book because I had no money. I did that tour because I couldn't get a better one. And then you look at it all and you think, wow, it all fits together. Mm-hmm. I can see a plan there that I couldn't see when I was doing it.
That has certainly been the case with me.
And I'm wary of over-strategizing the spiritual and creative life. You know, you have people who say, okay, I'm going to be an artist. Here's my business plan.
Right.
I mean, you have to have a business plan, but it mustn't be your art. Your art has to somehow have its own life.
Right.
And all spiritual magic is like that. You can only get the overview after you've been doing it for some time. You can't start with an overview.
I agree with that. I think what I was trying to get at was you didn't start out playing five different instruments. You started out playing one.
Yes.
That was the only point I was trying to make.
To do with the priest and priestesses analogy. Okay.
Right.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Once you've learned one instrument well, though, it's easier to pick up a second instrument and a third.
Pick up other ones, yes, because what becomes important is the ability to be with the music and be coordinated physically and mentally. And magic is the same. What's important is the ability to be with the magic and be coordinated in it physically, mentally, and emotionally. And that only comes with practice and training.
So do you feel that at this point, speaking of the powers of air, that the inspiration and the music flows through you? Do you feel like a vessel for that, or is there some other process that's happening?
I think there are a sort of, there's a kind of wheels within wheels that goes on, so that anyone has an individual experience of their inspiration, the energies that flow through them, the things they try to create, the magic they try to work. And then there's another wheel, or sphere, if you like. It could be spheres within spheres, which encompasses that, which is part of tradition. And I feel that tradition is very, very important for us. You know, it's a bigger sphere that nourishes our individual sphere. I always acknowledge my teachers, W.G. Gray, Alfred Ronald Heaver, Patricia Crowther, probably the oldest living Gardnerian high priestess, was a big influence on me, although I was never a Gardnerian initiate. I always acknowledge these people because they embody spiritual traditions without which my little sphere wouldn't have its nourishment from some bigger sphere. And then there are these greater things, these mysterious things that are to do with planetary consciousness. And that's where everything is in some big sphere, where all our spiritual work is a part of some big cycle, some big pattern to do with planetary awareness, planetary life, human evolution. So I see spheres within spheres and wheels within wheels. And as time goes on and I do more, I find, you know, I claim ownership of my own writing and music, like everybody should, but that you get in touch with these greater sources of inspiration that flow through you and are not personal to you in any way.
That's also my experience. It's really interesting to hear you talk about this. You know, I liken those spheres within spheres you're talking about to something that I've started calling the cosmosphere as an expansion of the biosphere, you know, that we're a necessary part of that cosmosphere, yet this context we're in of this these larger and larger spheres, as you say, nourish our work. And the other thing I find myself saying is the work flows through me. I'm a conduit for the work. I am not the work. Yet the work, the way it flows through me, doesn't flow through anyone else. You know, all my years of training, all my years of practice, all of the joys and sorrows of my life have formed me in such a way that this particular current of art can move through T-Thorn Coil.
You know? Yes. Yes. Yes, and I think this is where the true service of a priestess or priest in our magical sense really comes into play, because the true service is that the spiritual power flows through you, but you are able to do something unique with it in service. You're not just a passive gateway.
That's right. And a lot of our training is to move and shape this flow.
Yes, and to make it appropriate for our time. You know, a lot of the stuff, I mean, you know, we've been talking about bardic inspiration and so on, and I get very annoyed with neo-Celtic, neo-bardic, syrupy romanticism, because that's like an unhealthy shadow of what these traditions really are. We have to take these things and make them valid and appropriate for our own time, not do some romantic escapism to a fake spiritual world of any background, any culture, that actually never really existed.
Well, and that latter is really important to me, that they didn't really exist in that form, that it is just a romantic vision. You know, there are very important things to be learned from our ancestors, and I think you're right that truly honoring our ancestors is taking the work forward, and not leaving the magic and the gods and the music stuck in time, that it needs to move forward and be expressed. I think that's really a valid point. And that it's truly honoring them to be a contemporary human.
I had a little laugh there because you reminded me of a very dramatic psychic incident that I had years ago, which I'd like to tell you about, which is humorous, but also, you know, responds to your point. I'd been out partying with a load of musicians years ago.
That's so surprising.
When I was living in Bath in England, I woke up early in the morning with a terrible, terrible hangover. Nowadays, I wouldn't drink that much. I drink in extreme moderation now. But back then, I, like all musicians, I drank and partied a bit more. And I'm lying there on the couch, sort of moaning. And suddenly, I was seeing the inside of a yurt with all these beautiful woven rugs. And there were horses running by outside. And lying on a mat on the floor was an old man who also had a hangover. And he's lying there moaning. And somehow we got into psychic communication with each other. And then he became aware of me, and he knew that I could see him. And he sort of sat up and he said, "Where are you?" And I said, "Oh, I'm in Britain." He says, "In Britain? I want to ask you a really important question." And I thought, wow, this is it. You know, this is an old shaman in Siberia. Something big is going to happen now. Remember, I was only like in my mid-20s. And he sort of drew his consciousness up and said, "What kind of stereo do you have?" And, you know, it was like he was in his world, he was the shaman, but he was also making his life appropriate to the modern world.
That's amazing.
Didn't ask me any spiritual questions or give me any deep advice, he just wanted to know what kind of stereo I had.
That is beautiful.
And, you know, we often think that spiritual communication and getting in touch with masters and goddesses and so on is going to be ethereal and radiant, and often it is. But sometimes it's just mundane.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that old shaman was asking me a question about how could we live together? How could I, as the modern young man in Britain, and he as the tribal elder in Mongolia, what could we share in common? What things could we share?
Mm-hmm.
Very, very interesting. And unfortunately, I was a bit more naive in those days than I am now. I was so shocked at his question that the contact broke, so I never had a chance to answer.
I find that also to be true, RJ, in my work with the gods and spirits of place, especially that they're living in our world, or touching our world, I should say. They're touching our time, is more accurate. And they're interested in what I and we are doing now, and how can they help that? And what's that current relationship with current events and patterns? Because current events and patterns, of course, affect what I call all the realms, seen and unseen. So
Yes. Why
wouldn't they be interested in that, you know? Current events are affecting the ancestral realms and the realms of the Shining Ones and the realms of the gods, so why wouldn't they want part of that through their priests and priestesses, through the bards, through the witches and magic workers?
Yes, and this again goes back to one of the touchstones of spiritual contact, is it has a kind of practical validity. It's never romantic escapism.
It's definitely true. My primary Contact with a capital C, is working with me because he, she, Z, it, whatever we want to name this force, is very interested in the particular times we live in and finds it necessary to come closer to be of more help.
Yes. Yes, and, you know, it's through humans, it's through us, through those that do their spiritual work, or all of us, that these other forms of consciousness, no matter what they are, that really is how they interact with our outer world of nature. There's a common mistake, which regrettably is widely believed, that inner spiritual contacts are extremely wise and they know everything and they see everything. That's not true.
Right.
They sense, see, and feel, I won't say through us, but in partnership with us. And in return, they help us to sense, see, and feel the other dimensions. There's a deal, there's a trade, there's a fair exchange. And this idea of exalted beings that know everything is purely a human illusion.
I agree. I mean, I find that the stronger I become in my own work and practice, the more it's like any other relationship. You know, it really does feel like partnership. That's a good word for it. I have something they need, and they have something that I need, and it's a mutually beneficial relationship.
Yes, and this unfortunately, is the origin of some of the unhealthy ideas about making pacts and bargains with spirit beings. You know, you see unhealthy ideas about making pacts and contracts, but there's a healthy and harmonious and beautiful side to it, which, of course, is what we have to all try and aim for.
So you do a lot of work in the fairy realms, and I'm wondering if they influence your music just as they influence other parts of your life. How does that work for you?
Well, first of all, I would say it comes and goes. The fairy contacts come and go according to mysterious rhythms of their own. So that sometimes I've been doing this fairy and underworld work for a very long time. I mean, really at least 30 years. And if anyone's curious, I'm 60 this year. This year is my 60th year. So I didn't start off doing fairy stuff, but by the time I got into my late 20s and early 30s, I was very deeply involved in it in Britain. And it has mysterious cycles and rhythms, and often I don't hear anything from them at all, and then suddenly a lot of new stuff will start to push at my awareness, especially about change. You know, we have these big changes going on that we really all started to be aware of in the late 1990s. And, you know, we have this mysterious 2012 galactic sidereal alignment coming up. And these are not just propaganda or nonsense. They are to do with the cycle of the planets and the sun and the stars. And these powerful spirit beings of our Earth, which is what the fairy beings are, of course sense this, and they want to come into communion with us to do with these changes of energy and consciousness. So I have, I suppose, really two levels of the fairy work. One is around my garden. I have a big wild garden here in Northern California, you know, where we do offerings and there are the spirit beings of the land and we try to come into harmony with them because they're our neighbors. And then there's the bigger scale thing. Some of the allies or cousins that I have are larger, more powerful beings. And to be quite truthful, they're often doing something else. Why should they be hanging around me all the time?
Right.
But, you know, they have other things to do. But sometimes they come through very strongly.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they teach methods of spiritual work. Sometimes they give insights into changes that are coming. And so what I found is to let it come, let it go.
Mm-hmm.
People get very over-enthusiastic about spirit contact. They get evangelical and excited about it. But the truth is, and I'm not being sarcastic when I say this, it's only spirit contact.
Right.
People have been having spirit contact for thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years. It's normal and natural. And the way to work with it is let it come, let it go, and keep your human common sense.
Mm-hmm. I found that in my experience, too, when I was in an earlier phase of my training, what we might call the she would come to me, the big towering light beings would come to me often, and they don't come to me as often anymore unless they have a message to pass on in a teaching. You know,
yes.
I find like if I'm doing a work with a group of people and there needs to be a message conveyed, they'll come in really strongly and, you know, the hair will stand up on the necks of everyone present and you can really feel the palpable presence, and then they go away again.
Yes.
So the ones that I have more regular contact with are, as you say, like my household spirits, things like that. Yeah, that's interesting.
And I think that's the experience of, I mean, for example, who was it now? I think it was A.E., the Irish mystic, George William Russell, who said that, you know, close to human habitation, there are these fairies that look like human beings. And, you know, you can find them around the houses and so on. But when you get out in his day, remember, this is the late 1800s, early 1900s, when you get out into the remote places in Ireland, there you find the vast beings radiant with light. And you don't find them sitting under a rock in your garden.
Right.
you have to go to them and allow them to come to you. They're not your neighbors. They're of a higher order.
Yes.
And Fiona MacLeod has this wonderful line about the wind and the rain blowing, and somebody in the drama, the immortal hour, says, "Who knows who comes and who goes when the wind and the rain blow?"
Hopefully, they're friendly.
Yes, well, of course, that's the big message in Fiona MacLeod is, you know, are they friendly? And the situation with that is one of the things that concerns me is the sentimentality we see about fairies now. The same with angels.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we read the book of Ezekiel or something from the Old Testament, the angels that are described in there are powerful and terrifying.
Yes.
We read the old descriptions of the fairy beings. The Reverend Robert Kirk says, they are of human size and greater.
Right.
And these little sentimental figures that are so commercialized really don't do anybody any favors, neither humans nor fairies, because they don't strengthen the contact, they block it.
You know, I didn't think of this until now, RJ, but I think there's, you know, we often talk about trivialization or demonization of the old powers, but I now have a sense there's something else going on with the trivialization, and that is it's a diminishment of humanity, even more than it's a diminishment of the other realms. Because if these beings are small and frivolous, we don't have to grow larger and stronger and more capable and into our adepthood and into our full power. We can remain small and complacent ourselves. And that really, really strikes me that in diminishing these other beings, what we're really doing is diminishing ourselves. It's a lack of respect on all levels.
Yeah, thank you. That's a very powerful observation. Thank you. Yes. Yes, indeed. And it's almost a feature of our time.
Yes.
It's like people have to do trivial things. our obsession with trivial entertainment, our obsession with trivial toys. It's as if that there's some pressure that we're not allowed to be anywhere near our full potential.
That's certainly the message that the overculture gives us. And thankfully, there's a strong undercurrent, though, of serious seekers that I've been encountering a lot of lately. You know, you and I were just at PantheaCon, and I noticed when I was teaching that everyone's questions and comments were really deep and from their being rather than just frivolous from their head. And I want to talk with you about how we can encourage that, you know, how we can encourage people to really be open to the instruction that you invoked as a power of air at the beginning of this podcast and this deepening of our magic and our practice and our connection with the element of air, with knowledge, with thought, with contact with spirit, all the other things that go along with that. Do you have any ideas on that?
Well, I think that really powerful inspiration works through very small networks. I don't, for example, believe in the idea that, you know, the inspiration of one man or woman does it all.
Right.
When we see the powerful inspiration of wonderful figures in human history, although she or he will stand out, they're actually part of a network.
Yes.
And we don't hear about the rest of the network so much. So I think the key thing is small groups and networks rather than large-scale movements, because large-scale movements are tidal. They come and go. They peak, and then they fade away. One of my teachers who I mentioned earlier, William Gray, used to say that the old occult groups were what originated the cell system that was used in revolutionary communism.
Mm-hmm.
Because you only had so many people in each group, and nobody knew who was in all of the groups.
Right.
And I thought for a long time this was a political description, but of course it's not. It's how things survive in nature.
I agree.
Is they have these cellular networks whereby even if one whole piece of the network is destroyed, the rest of it continues because each separate part is a holism unto itself.
If this is where I find that groups like the Theosophists went wrong. They were looking for the world teacher. You know, the one great teacher that would unite us all. And I think that that's dangerous thinking and it's counterproductive. And I find my spirit gets fed and inspiration continues to flow through me. The more, of course, I do my practices and work with my own contacts, but also the more I work with peers, with networks of other powerful people, and of course with my groups of students. And I find that, you know, when those of us who are doing these various practices get together to share information, we all find that we have one thread of the pattern. I mean, you and I have talked about this before, how it's important for us to periodically meet with other like-minded people to see, oh, where's your work taking you? What information is coming through? Because what information is coming through your vessel and your practice is going to be a little bit different than the information coming through me. And it's necessary to everything, all the patterns that are forming now.
Well, also, this is a really important point. There's another thing that comes through, which is beyond information. It's like a deeper energy or consciousness that is beyond information.
Right.
And as groups get deeper into their practices, they start to mediate this deeper spiritual energy, which can shape up as information, but often is more about qualities of being,
yes,
powers of transformation, seeds that are planted and you don't even know what they're going to grow into. But if you work with integrity, you know that whatever they're going to grow into will match the integrity that has brought them through and planted them.
That's right. That's my sense too. When I drop back and really open to that, there is a powerful energy that moves through, and it helps develop what I call being with a capital B. You know.
Yes. Yes. And of course, ultimately, you know, we talked about inspiration and instruction, and really the instruction is about how to be yourself.
Right.
Ultimately, there's no other instruction we can receive. It takes us a long time to get there.
Well, it's true. It can take a lifetime, and, you know, everything's in process always. The whole cosmos is in process, and all the gods are in process. And everything needs to come into the fullness of its nature. I once asked my teacher, Victor Anderson, what the Fae wanted from me. And he said, for you to become more human, for you to become more yourself.
Yes.
And that's been a powerful teaching for me ever since.
Yes. Yes, you know, there's an interesting thing there, because everyone who does magical work, who does rituals, pagan ceremonies, whatever we may care to call it, goes through a phase where they lose some of their humanity. It happens to all of us. And then I think what Victor was talking about was coming back into that humanity in a deeper, more compassionate way, like finding humanity again, having wandered far from humanity, often in rejection. Often, you know, we go through phases where we reject the world around us for very good reasons.
Right.
But the secret is not to stay in rejection, to come into a new kind of compassionate and loving acceptance at a deeper level of being.
I agree. I find that these days it's really important for me to have an expanded view of what humanity is, that as a full human, I have my animal nature, I have my intellectual nature, and I have my divine nature. And if all those are working in concert, I'm more fully human and have that compassion you speak of. It's why I'm often, despite the true horrors that humanity still commits, I'm often awash with great love for humanity in all of our processes. It doesn't mean I don't get cranky with humans. But, you know, even the crankiness has affection in it, I think.
You know, in that context, there was a very interesting thing that came up several times at PantheaCon this year, which is to do with how pagans and witchcraft people relate to the other religions and the other paths. And suddenly we're seeing these strong moves in the pagan world, which are to do with love and compassion and acceptance, where pagans have suddenly discovered that they can offer something in the interfaith movement that nobody else can offer, because the modern pagan and witchcraft revival is based on acceptance.
Right.
Like, we accept people. We don't reject them. We accept them. And for many, many years, the early phases of revival paganism were reaction.
Right.
They were part of the reaction of the 60s against authority.
Right.
But now, suddenly, it was made very clear at several things at PantheaCon that it's the pagans that can mediate between the Christians and the Muslims,
mm-hmm.
for example, because they're not either. And because they have an acceptance that the more rigid religions do not have, no matter how much those rigid religions talk about compassion.
Well, and there's also the important facet that we bring of the immanent sacred, you know, the immanent divine, that the divine flows through everything and is not separate from us. And that lack of separation, of course, in its greatest form fosters, of course, greater connection, which is of help to us all.
Yes.
Well, RJ, our time is coming slowly to a close. I'm wondering if you have any further thoughts before we leave each other about air, about inspiration, or about inner teaching. You know, we've touched on all of those and also gone off on some fabulous tangents. So I'm wondering, do you have anything else to say about that?
Well, I think I would probably say something that's been on every conscious person's mind in these last 2 or 3 months, which is that with a new president, we're hearing words of inspiration, the like of which we've not heard for 8 years. And I feel that to be very important in a talismanic sense, not merely in a political sense, because who knows what this new administration has to struggle with? Who knows how successful they'll be? We just don't know. But there's such a powerful spiritual talismanic force of waking up, of a new dawn, of a new inspiration. And that, I think, is not by any means coincidence. It's part of a tide, a wave of inspiration, a wave of new ways of being. And suddenly, for the first time, we've seen it manifest in national and international politics. Isn't that incredible?
It is incredible. And it's been interesting for me to watch my own interior reactions to this, despite, you know, wanting to wait and see what will happen. My spirit responds to those. And calling them talismanic, I think, is very key to that response I've been feeling. And I'm hoping you can unpack that word for us a little bit more.
Well, a talisman is, or should be, something that has a shape and a pattern that enables a power to come through from other dimensions into this dimension. Now, people often confuse talismans and amulets. I think an amulet is maybe a lesser, more protective tool, whereas a talisman is a pattern, like it might be, as we know, a pattern made on parchment, or it might be a solid object, which acts as a gateway for spiritual power. Now, a group of people can also be a talisman. A political group can, and indeed should, be a talisman. In other words, the dynamic of their pattern, the dynamic of their ancestral heritage, the dynamic of their ideas makes a talisman, and we can look at it as a shape and we can say, yes, the power is coming through that. And if it's a group of people, like, say, a new president and his administration, whether they succeed or fail in every strategy is not important. It's the fact that they are a talisman, the like of which we've not seen in this country for a very long time.
Thank you for that. That feels really helpful, and it feels like a beautiful note on which to close our session on air and the powers of air. Because talismans, of course, part of what they focus, they don't only focus energy, they focus thought and intention. So I'd really just love to, breathe into that for a moment together. And I want to thank you, RJ. This has been a fruitful conversation. You have some.
Well, thank you very much.
You are welcome. You have some workshops coming up in March in Santa Rosa and Santa Cruz. Is that correct?
Yes, in Santa Rosa, which is the first one in mid-March, that's called Working with Inner Contacts. It's how to make contact with spirit contacts and how to stay with it and work with it in a balanced manner. And then in May, the workshop in Santa Cruz is The Mystery of the Seven Directions, where I'm teaching some new methods of working with the energies of the rotation of the planet and the poles of the planet and the cycle of sleep and dawn and so on, where we get some new awareness of the energies of the seven directions for our spiritual work. Because seven directions are often something everyone says, oh yeah, I know about that. East, south, west, and north, up, down, and in. But it's a mystery that we're still learning after millions of years of evolution.
That sounds wonderful. And people can find details about that at rjstewart.org.
And yes.
I have many, many events coming up if people check my calendar section. My new book, Kissing the Limitless, has been released, and I'll be doing a lot of workshops and book signings in support of that over the spring and summer. So please check my calendar at thorncoil.com. And I'd like to thank the element of air and inspiration and teaching. And I'd like to thank all the elements, fire, water, earth, and ether, and say, Holy Mother, in whom we live, move, and have our being, from you all things emerge, and unto you all things return. Blessed be.
Blessed be.
Oh, you lovers, stand with me. Rise.